Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. For 28 days in June of 1985, Lexington and Richland counties in South Carolina were petrified as a monster walked among them, snatching girls in broad daylight. And it wasn't just the kidnappings that terrorized those sleepy small-town communities. Serial killer Larry Jean Bell relished in making phone calls to one of the families, both before and after their daughter's body was found. 17-year-old Sherry Faye Smith and 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick were taken during the searing hot first days of summer, and their pitiful bodies were left to rot in that same awful heat for days, crippling the forensic autopsy investigations. But Larry Jean Bell wasn't as smart as he thought. It took 28 days, but they did get him. He is suspected in at least 3 other unsolved abductions. He had a record of assault and attempted kidnapping and had served time in prison. In his calls to the Smith family, he sickeningly focused on Sherry Faye's sister, insisting to speak with her on the phone, even after Sherry Faye's body had been found. Welcome to Episode 48, The Abduction and Murder of Sherry Faye Smith. This is part one of a 2-episode series on the crimes of Larry Jean Bell. The Midlands region of South Carolina is literally just the middle area of the state. It's where the state capital, Columbia, is located, and it's a dividing point between the upstate and lowcountry. But it's an important distinction in such a diverse state, culturally and geographically. The upstate is the westernmost part of South Carolina, also known as upcountry. It includes the 10 counties along the I-85 corridor and the commerce-rich corner of the state. Situated between Charlotte and Atlanta, the upstate or upcountry portion of the state is the fastest-growing part of South Carolina. Several large national and global corporations are located upstate, including BMW, the luxury automobile maker from Germany. Lowcountry is along South Carolina's coast, including the Sea Islands. Lowcountry was once a place of agricultural wealth in rice and indigo dye, which flourished in the hot subtropical climate on the backs of slaves. Today, Lowcountry is more about the natural environmental treasures, historic communities, cultural heritage, and tourism. The Midlands lie between the two areas, one more filled with modern commerce and the other more focused on history and tourism. But the Midlands region has become a major business center in the state in the textile, paper, medical, and steel industries. Its economy also relies heavily on tourism. South Carolina is known as the Palmetto State, and Columbia, the state capital and largest city in the state, has its own treasure trove of historic landmarks, gorgeous sites, and plenty of outdoor adventures. You can canoe down the Saluda River along miles of unspoiled riverbanks or enjoy boating on beautiful Lake Murray. There are luxury golf courses, sport fishing, hiking with beautiful vistas, historical landmarks, and maybe most importantly to many of us, some of the best southern seafood eatings to be had in South Carolina. Stranger danger, a phrase synonymous with the 1980s, actually began in the 1960s in the United States, though the conviction of Ian Brady and Myra Henley of England in 1966 is a really good example of the first real public warnings of predators. But in the U.S., the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh in 1981 really kicked off the stranger danger panic of Americans. I was born in 1974, and by 1985, when Larry Jean Bell was abducting children, my parents were already all over this. The widespread concern started in 1984 when the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was founded. When I was 9 or 10 years old, I was playing on a swing set after school with a friend, waiting for my bus. We were linking our legs together to make a bigger swing than another little girl could sit on when a strange man walked up with a camera. He told us he was with our town newspaper, and the other girls were happy to pose and smile. I ran. My parents had instilled this in me. And I was pissed when the following Sunday, on the front page were three other little girls, posing for the man who had asked us for the photograph. He was legit. But I remember my mom saying, "I don't care. I'm so proud of you for running away. He could have been a liar. He could have been a bad man. You can't take that chance, Erica. Always run." I think my parents, late hippies, were in tune with the stranger danger emergence in the United States, even if the rest of the country was still catching up. They may have been a little overprotective, but the age of milk carton kids and stranger danger had begun to permeate their nightly news. It was no longer okay to tell your kid to go ride bikes until dark. Now it was stay close to our yard, be home before the streetlights come on. As a kid, I thought it was dumb, but they were not wrong. As an adult and a true crime researcher, it's difficult to give my 16-year-old teenager a reasonable curfew. But both Sherry Faye Smith and Deborah Mae Helmick were abducted out of their driveways and front yards. These girls weren't riding bikes where they weren't supposed to. They weren't out too far past dusk. And their parents were watching. It only took seconds. Sherry was checking the mail at the end of her parents' 750-foot-long driveway. Deborah was playing in the front yard of a trailer with her 3-year-old brother, a tiny yard within eyeshot of many people. Their abductions in broad daylight terrorized the Midlands for 28 days. I'm going to pause now for a quick word from one of today's sponsors. I feel like I spend so much time shopping and spend way too much money on name brand clothes. Swap.com is like an awesome thrift shop right at my fingertips. I've got a teenage daughter with a taste for name brands, and this site is a dream come true for her and my pocketbook. On Swap.com, you can easily sift through millions of clothes in seconds, online or on their mobile app. They have easy-to-use filters, so you can find what you need quickly. But also, do you tend to collect brand new clothes that just hang in your closet going to waste? I'm very guilty of this. Swap.com can take those clothes off your hands and make sure they find a good home. Swap.com has something for the whole family, with women's, men's, juniors, kids, baby, and maternity clothes. And Swap.com's quality inspection team reviews every single item and only accepts the best, so that you can trust giving online thrift shopping a try. And save up to 90% on your favorite brands like Nike, Carter's, J. Crew, and The Gap. I've got a special offer just for Southern Fried listeners. Go to swap.com/southernfried, and once there, sign up to get free shipping on your first purchase. Just make sure you enter your email address to get the offer. That's swap.com/southernfried. Get started today with some guilt-free shopping. Go to swap.com/southernfried. This sad story begins with 17-year-old Sherry Faye Smith, who, while known to be a friendly girl, still wouldn't have taken candy or petted a puppy from a stranger. But when she stopped her car at the foot of the driveway to check the mail, a man pulled up, got out, quickly put a gun to her head, and dragged her into his car. Her mother had initially seen her pull into the driveway to check the mail. When Sherry didn't come in a few minutes later, her dad looked out the window and saw that her car was still there, with the driver's side door wide open. But Sherry had disappeared. It was exactly 3:25 p.m. on Friday, May 31st, 1985. Her family didn't wait. Sherry had a rare form of diabetes called diabetes insipidus, which causes an imbalance of fluids in your body. If she didn't drink enough water, she could easily become disoriented and walk away. But the disorder also causes frequent urination, and it wouldn't have been unusual for Sherry to run to a bush for relief instead of trying to make it to the house to use the bathroom. So her dad, mom, and sister raced to her car, which was still running, and found her insulin still in her purse. They immediately ran and started shouting Sherry's name and looking all over their property and the surrounding woods. They knew she would never go anywhere without her insulin unless she was having a diabetic episode that hit her too quickly. They lived in the rural Red Bank community about 10 miles from Lexington. Sherry came from a very religious family, and they were also very close-knit. She had one brother named Robert, and she and her younger sister Dawn sang together at church and other functions. They wanted to make it big time in the Christian music scene. Along with their extraordinary musical talent, they were both blonde with blue eyes and exceptionally beautiful. And Sherry was almost on the eve of her high school graduation. She had worked really hard and was set to graduate with honors that Sunday. That hot Friday, May 31st, she had been at a celebratory pool party for graduates. She was due to sing the Star Spangled Banner at the graduation ceremony with another classmate. The Smith girls always called home when they were about to leave somewhere so their parents wouldn't worry. And always the conscientious kid, Sherry called her mom before she left the pool party around 2:30 with her boyfriend Richard. She was wearing white shorts and a yellow tank top over a yellow and black polka dot bikini. Sherry sat in her car with her boyfriend Richard talking at around 2:45. After a few minutes, they kissed goodbye and he followed her for a while on the main road, Highway 1, towards her home before turning off to head to his own house. Then she pulled into her driveway at 3:25 p.m. and vanished into thin air. Sherry's black jelly shoes she had worn to the pool party were also still in the car, and her bare footprints were found all around the car walking to the mailbox, and then they stopped. There were no return tracks. She was taken right at the mailbox. Though the Amber Alert system wouldn't begin in the United States until 1996, the Sheriff's Department immediately responded to the Smith's call due to Sherry's medical condition. Search parties were quickly formed. Airplanes were also called in quickly to help in the search. Even the Emergency Preparedness Division of the Governor's Office set up a trailer by nightfall on the Smith's property, equipped with telephones and radios so searching officers could communicate quickly. By the next day, they knew Sherry had been taken. If she had become disoriented and wandered away, she would have been found by then. There was one bogus call on Saturday with a man saying he had Sherry and wanted money. But they traced the call and found it was a hoax. Law enforcement began asking neighbors if they had seen suspicious vehicles in the area. Two men had been passing by when Sherry was at the mailbox. They saw her and then were passed on the road by a reddish-colored car that looked like an Oldsmobile Cutlass. They passed back by the house about 10 minutes later and noticed Sherry's car was still there and the door was open. They described the driver to be in his 30s but didn't really get a good look. Instead of a celebratory weekend, Sherry's friends and classmates joined the search parties. Her parents were terrified but remained hopeful. At 2:20 a.m. that Monday morning, June 3rd, they received another phone call. Sherry's mother had answered the phone, and she said the man's voice sounded muffled and disguised. He told Mrs. Smith exactly what Sherry had been wearing that day so she would know it wasn't a hoax. He informed her that the family would be receiving a letter that day from Sherry around 2 p.m. That was the usual time their mail was delivered. The caller said that the date 6/1/85 would be at the top of the letter along with a time of 3:10 a.m. Then he said that they were looking in the wrong place and told Mrs. Smith to get Sheriff Metz to get on TV that morning at 7 a.m. and call off the search. The mysterious caller had made no ransom demand, but they were sure he had Sherry. This call wasn't recorded, but Mrs. Smith was scribbling everything he said down on paper. Law enforcement was able to trace the call to a phone booth about 5 miles outside of Lexington and 12 miles from the Smith home. The caller was gone by the time the police got there, and they found no prints on the phone. The Lexington County postmaster had been alerted about the incoming letter. He allowed the police to sift through the mail before it was sorted so they could find the letter from Sherry. They found it in a bag from the Columbia Distribution Center. It was found by 7 a.m., and Sherry's father went to the post office so it could be legally delivered to him. Inside the envelope, which of course had no return address, were 2 pages from a yellow legal pad. Both were filled with Sherry's distinctive cursive handwriting. The SLED, South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, had their handwriting expert confirm what the Smiths already knew. It was indeed Sherry's handwriting. And the title of the letter was Last Will and Testament. Sherry began the letter with, "I love you, Mommy, Daddy, Robert, Don, and Richard." It was a heartbreaking goodbye letter. She asked her family to remember the good times and, quote, Please don't let this ruin your lives. Just keep living one day at a time for Jesus. And after a sentence that read, "My thoughts will always be with you and in you," the words "casket closed" were in parentheses, written in clear print, not cursive. The letter goes on with Sherry telling her family repeatedly how much she loved them, with special notes to different family members. She ended the letter with the words, "Please do not become hard or upset. Everything works out for the good for those that love the Lord. All my love always, Sharon Sherry Smith." There were hearts and smiley faces. On the left side of the first page, running down the column, were the words, "God is love." Instead of immediately taking this as Sherry's last words, the Smith family kept their faith, praying that Sherry may have been forced to write this, but that she was still alive. It was dated Saturday. This was Monday. Meanwhile, law enforcement set up another phone line at the Smith home for incoming and outgoing calls so that their original phone line would be open at all times. They set up a recording device on the original line. At 3:08 p.m. that same day, a second call came through from the same man. Dawn answered the phone, but he asked to speak with her mother. When Hilda Smith got on the phone, he asked her if she had received the letter. And then he asked if she believed him now. Mrs. Smith said yes, but only because she hadn't actually heard from Sherry. She said, "I need to know if Sherry is well." And he said she would know in 2 or 3 days. She wanted to know why, and he said, "Call off the search." She said, "Tell me if she is well because of her disease. Are you taking care of her?" And then he hung up. Later that day, the family gave a press conference, hoping it would draw Sherry's kidnapper out. The phone rang again at 8:07 that night. Dawn again answered, and the man again insisted to speak with Mrs. Smith. He asked again if she had received the letter, and then asked for proof, for her to tell him something that was in the letter. She told him there was a little heart on the side with "Char Richard" written beside it. When he seemed convinced that she wasn't lying, he said, quote, "I'm doing everything possible to answer some of your prayers, so please, in the name of God, work with us here." Sherry's mom kept agreeing with everything he said and begging to know about her daughter's health. Is she physically all right without her medication? He told her that Sherry was drinking a little over 2 gallons of water per hour and was using the bathroom right then. He then ominously said, "Okay now, this has gone too far. Please forgive me. Have an ambulance waiting at your house at all times." He also mentioned the casket closed quote from the note and said that if anything happened to Sherry, she had told him she wanted her hands on her stomach to cross her hands like she was praying in the casket. When Mrs. Smith kept asking if Sherry was with him, he said he wouldn't say, but he told her to tell the police to forget Lexington County and start looking in Saluda County. Before he ended the call, he said one more thing. He said, "Sherry is now a part of me physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. Our souls are one now." Sherry's mother pleaded with him to tell her daughter that she, her dad, and brother, and sister loved her, and she even said, quote, "God bless you for taking care of her." He answered, "Sherry is protected, and like I said, she is part of me now, and God looks after us all. Good night." He was playing with her. He made comments that Sherry was alive, but then kept making other sinister comments on where the police should be searching and begging for forgiveness. This call was traced to a phone booth just 8 miles from the Smith home, and even though they were ready and raced to the scene, he was gone. And again, there were no prints. And Sherry's letter indicated she knew she was about to die. It's possible she was forced to write that, but the Smiths found the language characteristics to be Sherry's. It's how she would have worded those sentences. Lieutenant Rita Schuler with the SLED was called out to photograph the letter. She was a supervisory special agent for the Forensic Photography Division of SLED. And in 2007, she would write a book about Sherry and Deborah Mae Helmick called Murder in the Midlands, Larry Jean Bell and the 28 Days of Terror that Shook South Carolina. Her publishing company, Arcadia, graciously sent me a copy of Ms. Schuler's book to use as a source for this episode. After Lieutenant Schuler had photographed the letter, and after the Smiths had read the contents, it was taken for further forensic processing. Sherry's prints were found on both pages. The SLED used an instrument called an electrostatic detection apparatus, or ESDA, which is used to develop indented writings from paper products. You may have seen a much simpler process of this kind in a movie, where a detective finds a pad of paper and lightly scribbles in pencil over it, showing what had been written on the last page torn off. The SLED didn't yet have the legal pad, so the ESDA machine was used for this process, and they discovered indentions of words like mother, Bob, and beef sticks. They also found what looked like a partial phone number, missing a digit. Investigators began trying different combinations of every number. In the meantime, the man called back on Tuesday night, June 4th, at 9:45 p.m. This time, he told Dawn to stay on the line and have her mother pick up another extension. He instructed them to get a pencil and paper, even though he noted the call was probably being recorded and traced. He kept insisting these were Sherry's final wishes, that on the fifth day, her family would be at rest. He noted the exact time he kidnapped Sherry, and then the exact time written on the letter from Sherry. He then told them that on Saturday, June 1st, at 4:58 a.m., he and Sherry had become one soul. They kept asking him what he meant, and he wouldn't say. But he did say, "Remember, have an ambulance ready." This time he said between 4 and 7 on Wednesday, the next day. They agreed, and then he said, quote, "Prayers and relief coming soon. Please learn to enjoy life. Forgive. God protects the chosen. Rest tonight and tomorrow. Good shall come out of this. Blessings are near." He again reminded them about the ambulance and said, "Remember, no circus." He had said this before, but now Dawn said, "No circus. What does that mean?" He answered, "You will receive last-minute instructions on where to find us." And now, Sherry's mother spoke out loud and clearly, "Do not kill my daughter, please. I mean, please." And then he said, "We love and miss y'all. Get good rest tonight. Goodbye." Again, the call was traced to a phone booth about 9 miles from the Smith home near Lake Murray. And again, the caller had vanished and left no evidence. A manhunt started around that area of Lake Murray, and roadblocks were set up, but he was gone. The roadblocks were taken down at 11:30 p.m. On the next day, 5 days after Sherry's abduction, as he had said in one of the calls, he called again at 11:54 a.m. This time, he said, "Listen carefully," and then quickly gave instructions to a Masonic lodge. Then, quote, "Go 1/4 mile, turn left at the white framed building, go to the backyard, 6 feet beyond. We're waiting. God chose us." And he hung up. The sheriff's department and SLED sprang into action and immediately went to where her kidnapper had instructed. Sherry Faye Smith's decomposing body was found almost exactly where he said, and it was indeed in Saluda County. Everything he said in the calls so far was true, except where he pretended that Sherry was still alive. She was found lying on her back. All of her clothing was intact except her bikini top was gone. She was barefoot. She had on a gold chain that her boyfriend had given her and one gold earring. The rest of her jewelry was missing. SLED investigators could tell she had probably been moved from the back of a truck or car and dragged to this spot. And with extreme temperatures reaching 100 degrees, decomposition and insect infestation was already present. An autopsy would confirm what crime scene investigators already believed. She had been dead at least 2 days, probably since early Saturday morning after she wrote the letter. The accelerated decomposition made it impossible to pinpoint the cause of death, though the coroner said it could be cardiac arrest from the dehydration her condition would have caused, or asphyxiation from strangling or smothering. The Smiths were devastated, and now they and law enforcement knew they were dealing with a true monster. Sherry was dead during every call he placed. He was enjoying tormenting her family. At this time, I'm going to pause to hear a final word from our sponsors. I don't know about you guys, but I'm ready to shake off the wintertime blues and spring back into a healthier routine to get ready for my busy summer. Care of delivers vitamin packets, protein and energy powders, and more right to your door. Care of's 5-minute quiz is new and improved to determine if you're getting enough protein, fiber, and good fats. They make it easy to see if you could use their new natural protein powders in your life. It can be really hard to know which vitamins and supplements you should be taking. Personally, I find the drugstore aisles overwhelming, so I really appreciate the ease of the Care of online quiz, which narrows down my choices based on my lifestyle, not just what's written on the back of a bottle. Care of now offers protein powders in individual packets or in tubs, all personalized for your fitness goals. I'm on a personal fitness journey, and I really like this new Care of product. There are also vegan and vegetarian options available for their protein shakes. And you can track your progress on the Care of app and earn rewards. It's so easy. For 50% off your first month of personalized Care of vitamins, go to takecareof.com and enter Southern Fried 50. That's takecareof.com and enter the promo code Southern Fried 50. I find sticking to a weight loss plan hard. There is often anxiety and time constraints keeping me from making progress. And even when I'm successful, it's usually temporary. It's because most weight loss plans tell you what to do before, not after you've achieved your goals. So let me tell you about Noom and how they can help you live a healthier lifestyle. With the Noom app on your phone, you've got support in the palm of your hand whenever you need it. You can visualize portion sizes, track your meal habits, and check calories at a glance. And you'll have personalized training and your own support team for less than the price of a single appointment with a nutritionist or personal trainer. And there's a community that is there for you with group discussions and fellow Noom members cheering you on. I told you about my own fitness journey this year, and with Noom, it just takes a few minutes a day to hold myself accountable and stay on track. So out with the old and in with the new. Sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/Southern Fried. What are you waiting for? Visit Noom.com/Southern Fried to start your trial today. Again, that's Noom.com/Southern Fried to start losing weight today for good. Even though Sherry Faye Smith's body had been found, the calls didn't stop. First, on Thursday afternoon, the day after Sherry's body was found, he called an investigative reporter for a local Columbia TV news station and told him he wanted to use him as a medium. The reporter's name was Charlie Keyes, and he listened to a long rant about how it was a mistake, how he knew the Smith family, and he felt bad that things went too far. But he kept insisting that Charlie call Sheriff Metz, and then proceeded to give him a phone number and tell him it was the sheriff's home phone number. He wanted Mr. Keyes to announce that number on the evening news. Mr. Keyes told him he didn't think he could do that, but the man kept insisting. He also said he wanted to turn himself in and begged Keyes to make sure that they took him in alive. He also wanted Charlie Keyes to personally be at the sheriff's house because he was going to call and wanted him to answer. And he promised Keyes an exclusive interview about exactly what happened to Sherry Faye Smith. Keyes tried to agree to things and even asked him if he wanted to tell him where he was. The man said no, that he would be listening to the news, and told Charlie Keyes he had better be there when he called the next morning. Keyes said okay, and they hung up. This was around 2:30 p.m. At around 9 p.m. at the Smith's home, the phone rang. The caller asked to speak to Dawn Smith, but her aunt had answered the phone and said, "This is her Aunt Beverly. She's not available." He then asked for Mrs. Smith, and she informed him that she was sedated and couldn't come to the phone. Beverly finally said, "Do you know what's going on here? You can talk to me." But the man insisted he had to talk to Dawn, and Beverly told him to hold on, that Dawn was walking the dog, but she would get her. Dawn got on the phone, and he told her that he was calling for Sherry Faye, and then he asked if she knew he was turning himself in the morning. Dawn said no. And he asked if she had talked to the sheriff or Charlie Keyes. Again, Dawn said no. He then said she would understand when she talked to Charlie Keyes, but said, quote, "He will not be able to get a personal interview for me." Now he said there is another letter on the way. And this one would include photographs of Sherry from, quote, the time I made her stand up to her car and took two pictures, and all through the thing, and the letter will describe exactly what happened from the time I picked her up until the time I called and told y'all where to find her. He then started hinting around to Dawn that he would kill himself. He spoke in circles, and it was hard to follow, but he said he would be armed by the time they found him, but he wouldn't be dangerous. She asked why, and he responded, Sherry Faye said if I couldn't live with myself, and she wouldn't forgive me if I didn't turn myself in or turn myself over to God. So I'm going to have to. This thing got out of hand. All I wanted to do was make love to Dawn. I've been watching her for a couple of... At which point, alarmed, Dawn interjected, to who? He said, I'm sorry, to Sherry. I watched her for a couple of weeks, and it just got out of hand. Dawn, I hope you and your family forgive me for this. Dawn caught that slip he made. She knew what he meant. But she tried to keep him talking. The police were still recording, and she would do anything she could to find the man who murdered her sister. She told him, We don't want you to die. We want to help you. Don't kill yourself. He said, I can't live in prison for the rest of my life or go to the electric chair. Then he went on to ramble about how Sherry said she would be an angel in heaven, and if he did the right thing, she would see him there. He rambled about her jewelry, specifically the earring and necklace she was found wearing. It was like he was giving her a list of things Sherry wanted done after her death, as if he and Sherry had planned her funeral and this was all perfectly normal. Dawn interrupted him and said, But Sherry was not afraid and she didn't cry or anything? No, she didn't do anything, he replied. Can you handle it if I tell you how she died? Dawn said yes, and he said, Okay, now be strong. He also kept repeating that he was a family friend, and that's why he couldn't face them. That would be one of many lies. He kept telling Dawn that she would find out in the morning, and then he suddenly went into excruciating detail about Sherry's death. Quote, Okay, I tied her up to the bedpost with electric cord, and she didn't struggle, cry, or anything. She let me voluntarily, from her chin to her head. I took duct tape and wrapped it all the way around her head and suffocated her. And tell the coroner or get the information out how she died. Dawn somehow held her composure and asked, When you killed Sherry, was she at peace? She wasn't afraid or anything? She was not. She was at peace, he said. She knew God was with her, and she was going to become an angel. Dawn said, And she wrote that letter to us of her own free will and all? She sure did, he interrupted. Everything I told y'all has been the truth. Hasn't everything come true? Yes, it has, Dawn darkly replied. And then she said, Can I ask you one more question? One more, and that's it, he said. You told us that Sherry was kidnapped at gunpoint. Yeah? But she knew you, Dawn prodded. She was letting him know that she was catching his lies. He now said he pulled up and Sherry willingly posed for two pictures by the mailbox before he pulled the gun on her. Dawn said, So, she didn't realize you were going to kidnap her? He said, That's exactly right. Then he told Dawn to tell Sheriff Metz to quit bothering with tracing calls and to call off the search. He wouldn't be taken alive. Suddenly, Dawn asked, Why are you talking to me instead of Mom? He said, She felt like you were more strong-willed than your mother. Remember, I told you on the fifth day to let them know where she was so her blessings of the body could be blessed, right? Dawn asked, Why? Why on the fifth day? He said he didn't know. She just said that. I'm telling you exactly how she died. So she died of suffocation. And so, okay, anything else? Why did you have to do that? Dawn pleaded. He then said, I gave her a choice, to shoot her or give her a drug overdose or suffocate her. Dawn asked why he had to kill her, and he just kept repeating it had gotten out of hand. This call went on for a long time, and at one point, Mrs. Smith got on the line, and she, like Dawn, told him not to kill himself. She told him God would forgive him. I could easily say these women were just trying to keep him on the phone. But the truth is, they were very devout Christians, and they meant it. They wanted to find him to make sure he didn't hurt anyone else, but they always meant what they said. When the call finally ended, the police had traced it to a phone booth at a truck stop in Great Falls, South Carolina, about 50 miles from the Smith home. but again, he was gone like a ghost. Visitation for Sherry Faye Smith, also known as Awake, was on the evening of Friday, June 7th. And whether it was her actual final wish or her killer's, it didn't matter. It was a closed casket. There would have been no other option anyway, considering the state Sherry's body was in by the time she was found. She was buried on Saturday morning. When the Smiths finally got home that afternoon, the phone rang at 2:21 p.m. He asked to speak to Dawn. This was another long and rambling call, but the difference was in tone. Dawn was not only in control, she'd had enough of his bullshit. Especially because he kept saying that he and Sherry had secrets, things like she was going to break up with her boyfriend. Dawn was getting angry, but she kept him on the phone. She asked questions about Sherry's jewelry, where the next letter was, and many others. But when he spoke, she only answered in one-word responses, like, uh-huh, yeah. Then she said, "Can I ask you something?" He said, "Okay, but hurry." Dawn said, "I know you keep telling me that you're telling the truth, but you did tell me that you would give yourself up at 6 o'clock this morning. What happened?" He told her that he didn't have the strength. She kept asking him exactly where Sherry died. He had given them the day and the time on a previous call, and so she kept nagging at where, hoping that he would reveal a clue to his whereabouts. He promised to call her the next Saturday at 4:58 a.m., the exact time Sherry died on what he called the anniversary date, and that he would tell her exactly where then. Dawn told him, "I can't believe this because you've never been telling me the truth." He said, "Well, Dawn, God bless us all," and hung up. This call was traced to Augusta, Georgia, some 60 miles away, and again, he left no prints. While the Smith family was grieving and Dawn was still willingly accepting phone calls from this creep, South Carolina authorities were doing everything they could. Lexington and Saluda counties both declared a state of emergency because there was still no proof of where Sherry was killed. She was abducted in Lexington, and her body was found in Saluda. The declared state of emergencies helped solidify the joint effort of these counties. And that's not all. The FBI offered technical assistance, and none other than the infamous FBI profiler and founder of their behavioral science unit, John Douglas, came to work with the SLED. He studied the case and the recorded calls and made a 22-point profile of the suspect. He said he was a white male, late 20s to 30s, single, had a blue-collar job with above-average intelligence, who probably worked in electrical contracting due to how the calls were electronically manipulated to disguise his voice. He would have a prior criminal record, but lived locally and managed to blend in. He would be asocial and obsessive-compulsive. He had no remorse for his actions. He felt like a nobody and was probably unattractive and overweight, with low self-esteem. John Douglas's profile was very specific and would turn out to be spot on in every way. Law enforcement also kept working with the press, with newspapers, local news, and even the Crime Stoppers TV show. Sheriff Metz was quoted as saying, "Somebody somewhere has seen him. Somebody somewhere knows him. We've got to find this person before he kills again." But so far, nothing was working. And on Friday, June 14th, at 4:07 p.m., exactly 2 weeks to the hour that Sherry Faye Smith had been abducted, he did it again. It was another sunny day, unseasonably hot for early summer in the Midlands, and blonde-haired, blue-eyed Deborah Mae Helmick was playing in the front yard with her 3-year-old brother. Again, she was snatched in broad daylight. But this time, there was an eyewitness. A man who could positively identify this monster who was terrorizing the Midlands. Larry Jean Bell had exactly 2 more weeks before he would be caught. And even though he took little 9-year-old Deborah May, he kept calling Dawn Smith. He was fixated on her. But he was now the subject of the largest manhunt in South Carolina history. Time was running out for Larry Jean Bell. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. The conclusion to this story, the crimes of Larry Jean Bell and his trials, will come out next week. Special thanks to Arcadia Publishing and SLED Lieutenant Rita Schuler for her incredible book, which was my main source for this episode and the conclusion. It's called Murder in the Midlands, Larry Jean Bell and the 28 Days of Terror That Shook South Carolina. It is available on Amazon, on Arcadia's website, Barnes & Noble, and wherever you buy books. Check out the show notes for links. And guess what, y'all? I'll be back at CrimeCon this year in New Orleans. I really hope some of you can make the trip. I'd love to meet you, and I'm looking forward to seeing familiar faces from last year. It's June 7th through the 9th, and if you're interested in going, please use my promo code to purchase your ticket. It's FriedCrime19. Several of your favorite podcasters will also be in the Big Easy, along with speakers, exhibits, workshops, and everything CrimeCon has to offer. So again, to buy a ticket, don't forget to use my code, FriedCrime19. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm on most large platforms like Stitcher and other podcatchers. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There is a link to my Patreon page. Patrons of Southern Fried enjoy many rewards like stickers, magnets, and t-shirts, as well as early ad-free listening to episodes. Or if you would like to buy a t-shirt or other merch, you can now directly do that from my website. And there is also a donate button if you would like to make just a one-time donation. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you have any comments, corrections, or suggestions, you can email me at southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys, and I'm always looking for new cases, so please feel free to reach out. I'm also all over social media. Just search the show name in your favorite platform. If you're interested in discussing this case or any other episodes further, come check out my discussion group. It's linked to my Southern Fried True Crime Facebook page. We don't just discuss the cases. We share memes, make friends, talk about current events and crime, and laugh at all things Southern. We'd love to have you. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.